Okay, Borodar Pyrbo, I could always already already have you. Welcome and good morning, everybody. Welcome to today's event. I'm Auriel Miller, Director of the IWA, the Institute of Welsh Affairs. And for those of you who don't know us, my question is why not? We are Wales's leading independent think tank. We've got a long track record of shaping debates and influencing change in Wales through our policy research and advocacy, our online and print publications that you can see behind me, which provide platforms for robust comment and debate and our agenda setting events. We're politically independent. We don't represent a specific sector, trade, or interest group. And instead, what we do is seek to bridge policy and institutional divides and show what might be possible when we work together differently, seeking consensus where possible, and robustly challenging the status quo when we need to. We're especially interested in identifying and facilitating long-term change on issues that will make a difference to Wales's economy and democracy. And most importantly, we're a membership organisation with nearly 1,000 members across Wales, the UK, and the rest of the world. So if it's your first time at an IWA event, you're very welcome. If you're a regular attendee, you're also very welcome. We hope you'll join us as a member and support our work if you're not already. Okay, so today is the second in our series of events, Wales, a Work in Progress. It's a series that explores the key debates around the constitutional and democratic future of our nation. If you missed our first event, you can watch that back or listen to it on our website. And in it, I discussed the unique devolution settlements across the UK, exploring where they differ and options for what might come next with Akash Pound, fellow at the Institute for Government. It's a conversation that's well worth a listen. In each of these discussions and events, we'll be unpicking the options open to us as we look to the nation's future on a diverse set of issues such as transport, social security, devolution settlements across the UK, and mainstreaming deliberative democratic methods. And in keeping with our independence, we don't take a position on Wales's constitutional future. Rather, we want to give voice to different opinions and openly examine the evidence to understand what might be the best path for Wales and why, so that people in Wales can make their own minds up. That's our key object as a charity. Our role is to convene these important conversations and unpick the evidence presented. And these events accompany our ongoing podcast of the same name, and you can find more information on that on our website. Our Constitutional Futures project is kindly supported by the Legal Education Foundation. So before we get started, a little bit of housekeeping, which I'm sure you're all well used to now. We do encourage you to introduce yourselves and engage with each other in the chat. We're really happy to see lots of our members today, but lots of new people too. We've got people joining us from universities of Cardiff, Bangor, Manchester, Prince's Trust, from the Welsh and UK governments, from the Senedd, the Welsh Language Commissioner's Office, the Isle of Anglesey County Council, Croeso Ynys Môn, Cateen, Real World Consulting, Audit Wales, Public Health Wales, and many more. Please do share your email if you're willing to be contacted by other attendees. Please send your questions via the Q&A function on Zoom, and we'll have lots of time for conversations. And the IWA audience is a very informed one, so we'll expect some really tough questions from Ari. Please remember that the chat all and the event all chat and questions are being recorded. We'll finish at midday, and if you'd like to tweet, you'd at us at @IWA_Wales, and we suggest using hashtag Wales in Progress as a hashtag. So video and audio of today's events will be made available on our website as well as via YouTube and podcast channels. Right, so that's all the housekeeping out of the way. We're on to the topic at hand, our guest and why you're all here. In Wales, the majority of social services, social security benefits are administered by the UK government, but social security touches on a wide range of devolved policy areas too, like housing, health and social care, education and skills. Today, we're going to be putting a spotlight on social security in Wales and asking, is it failing low and middle income households in Wales? We'll be looking at social security, particularly through a constitutional lens, examining how well the current system is working in Wales, what the case is for change, but most of all and primarily what we can learn from the Scottish experience of the devolution of welfare benefits. And I'm aware that there are lots of you who will be much further in the weeds of social security than me, so we'll be really relying on you for some of those differences. But today's an opportunity to hear from Mari about the Scottish journey and how that's worked. In this conversation, we're going to be addressing whether the powers that Wales has over welfare and social security are delivering for people on low and middle incomes as well, from a constitutional perspective. So to examine the Scottish case, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Professor Mairi Sparish, who's Director of the Fraser of Allender Institute at the University of Strathclyde. Croeso, Mairi. Mari sits alongside me as an expert panel member of the Independent Commission on the Constitutional Future of Wales. And again, we'll have lots of time for questions to Mari after our discussion. So do please get your thinking caps on. Welcome, Mari. Thanks very much indeed for taking the time to come and speak with us.
No, thank you very much for the invite.
Mari, would you like to set out first of all, obviously your expertise is in the social security system in Scotland. Can you just talk us through from our side of things, what has Scotland's journey been to greater devolution in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. And much of this is followed on from the 2016 Scotland Act, which came in the wake, of course, of the independence referendum. And as ever in Scotland, you can't look at any of this except without considering the big constitutional questions that are a fabric of our debate about pretty much everything we talk about in Scotland. So following the no vote in the independence referendum in 2014, the Smith Commission was established to set out what further powers could be devolved to Scotland in the wake of that no vote. And this follows the vow that was made by the then Prime Minister in the week up to the running up to the referendum, where the first poll showed perhaps it could be yes. So they rode up to Scotland and said, if you vote no, you will get a significant new package of powers will be devolved to the Scottish Parliament. So the day after the referendum, the Smith Commission was established. And the headline grabbing stuff from the Smith Commission proposals, which to be fair were published within a couple of months of the commission being established, which is lightning fast for these things, to be honest. The eye-catching things were around tax, and there was a lot of focus on the fact that income tax or the majority of powers around income tax would be devolved to Scotland. Because of obviously it's a very large amount of money potentially that we're talking about here. But also as part of that package, there was a proposal for a significant number of benefits to be devolved to Scotland. Now, the package of benefits does look a little curious if you look at it in the cold light of day, but many of them are linked to ill health and disability, and also things like cold weather payments and these sorts of payments that were made to people in specific circumstances. So this package of benefits, which around the time of devolution amounted to around £3.5 billion, is still a relatively small proportion of the total social security payments in Scotland. No powers over things like job seekers allowance or the state pension or anything like that. But it's the collection of benefits mainly that are related to ill health and disability. And Scotland's been on quite a long journey since the Scotland Act 2016 was established to actually implement these benefits in a practical sense. So there's been a long programme of setting up a social security agency in Scotland called Social Security Scotland, and that's not been without its issues, particularly over the cost of setting up that agency and recruiting appropriate staff. Also, there's been some phasing in of the benefits the new benefits that are being established. They've all been renamed because that has to happen if you devolve something to Scotland to call it something else. For example, the biggest benefit that's being devolved to Scotland is PIP, which is being replaced by the adult disability payment. And there's all sorts of bits of PIP, such as the child disability payment as well, which are also being devolved. So all of these things have been devolved and renamed, but it has taken a number of years for that to be done. And the first timetable was for this all to be completed by the end of the 2021 Parliament. Now we're looking at the end of the current Parliament. So by 2026, everything will be fully devolved and everyone who's on PIP in Scotland will transition over to the new devolved adult disability payment. The conversations about what to do with these benefits have been quite interesting. The political discussions in Scotland are often about moving away from what's seen as a cruel system that's run by Westminster, and particularly around things like PIP and related work capability assessments and so on, to have a much kinder approach to recognise that people are entitled to the benefits that they claim, certainly for the most part. Mm-hmm. And that they shouldn't be put through harsh sort of assessment systems in order to access those benefits that they are entitled to. So a much more a system that's just much more about helping people get what they're entitled to than putting barriers in the way to try and reduce the cost. So that has had some sort of fiscal consequences, which we can kind of come on to. But that's definitely been a part, it's in the fabric of the Scottish social security system, that there will be a kinder approach and that people will be encouraged to uptake the benefits for which they are entitled, rather than being put barriers in the way to ensure that people might be put off claiming. There's also been, as is a power under the Scotland Act, an approach to introduce new benefits where possible. And the main example of this is the Scottish Child Payment, which started off as a payment to children in qualifying households, which are identified through the fact that they claim certain parts of universal credit. £10 a week for each child that's in that household for children under five. That is now expanded to £25 a week for all children in those eligible households under 16. So it's it's a huge expansion in that that benefit. That also has fiscal implications, again, which we can come on to, because that isn't a benefit for which there's a corresponding adjustment to the block grant. That just has to be funded out of the Scottish Government budget. So it does mean that that's been prioritised instead of other types of spending that the Scottish Government could consider.
Okay, there's loads there to kind of start picking through. Thanks. Can we go to the changes in terms of adult disability payments and just picking up how that's administered differently in relation to, you know, getting rid of some of those barriers. So there's a very, very clear different ethos in terms of, you know, social security as a human right, not as something that is slightly out of reach and you need to justify why you'd be getting it. Can you talk about the practicalities of how that's administered differently?
Sure. So my understanding is that the assessment is less invasive, and I think as well it's not expected that it would be done as regularly. Okay. Once somebody, particularly when people with certain disabilities, which are obviously not going to change, and so it's these sorts of things that the assessment is different, and also isn't repeated endlessly to see if people's disabilities have changed when they're obviously not going to change, this sort of thing. But as I say, there's an issue right now, obviously, across the UK where the numbers of people on ill health and disability-related benefits has increased sharply. And that's also true in Scotland in terms of the base of people who are going to be claiming these benefits. If something happens across the UK, fiscally, the Scottish Government aren't any worse off, and we can talk about that in a second. But if there are Scottish-specific factors that mean people are more likely to claim the benefits, then again, that causes pressure on other elements of the budget. I'm not saying it's not the right thing to do from a policy perspective, but if you're encouraging more people to take up and helping more people to take up, then it is going to cost more also, which it does have a fiscal consequence.
Okay, so let's just zoom out a little bit. So you've got the devolution of certain benefits to Scotland with a corresponding decrease in terms of the block grant. You've also got the planning for that having happened on the basis of forecasts that were in existence at the time, but the whole process for putting them into place has taken much longer than expected. Yep. Plus, we've had the curveballs of both COVID and the Ukraine cost of living crisis since, and now that sharp rise in claimants across the UK. So you've got a situation that was planned for, but then the parameters have changed dramatically, as well as the kind of normal, in inverted commas, political decisions that any government would make in relation to what they want to do and how they want to achieve it and how they're going to spend the money, which is available to them and which is discretionary in terms of decision making to them as well. So there's some practical implications. You talked a little bit about how the setting up of the system, the new Scottish part of the system, has taken time, more time and more money. But there's also presumably something in there, which is the sort of how it's being received by people and the kind of engagement with people around that. So could you talk us through a little bit about some of those quandaries? Because obviously, you know, your point just now around if this is a UK-wide system, then Scotland gets a consequential from you know, additional spend in England, obviously, and that can be used, but that can't be planned for, and that's a one-off, not something in perpetuity too. So it's not straightforward.
No, it isn't, but it, just to correct a little bit what you said there about consequentials.
Thank you.
Because this is, oh no, it's okay, because this is outside of Barnett, because they're devolved benefits. So the Scottish funding position now is very complicated, because you have the block grant that used to be just get the block grant, you spend it, nice and easy. But now there's the block grant, and then there's all these block grant adjustments to reflect the fact that taxes have been devolved, which means the UK government have lost that revenue because the Scottish government gets it now. And social security payments have been devolved. So the UK government no longer have to pay it. So you whack a bit off for the taxes and you whack a bit back on for the payments for social security. And the issue really is that what that whack on or off is based on what's paid per head in the rest of the UK. So if there's a big issue across the UK where there's lots more spent on disability benefits, then and it happens to the same extent in Scotland, then it will work out that they were no better or worse off in terms of the budget. If there are Scottish specific factors that per head there's more likely to be payments, or there's more likely to be higher payments, that means that you know, the Scottish budget will be squeezed because we'll spend more than the block grant adjustment coming from Westminster. And on the benefits that have been devolved, and there is a block grant adjustment related to that, that's definitely the case. We're spending much more than we're getting in funding from Westminster, because it's not only that we're being kinder and there's higher take-up rate, it's also that generally the payments are more generous if you look across the suite of payments that we're making.
So again,
Scottish
those
are choosing to pay more.
Those are policy decisions that the Scottish government...
Those are policy decisions,
affecting
that
things.
The Scottish government... overall, in terms of kind of the way that the public are kind of receiving this, I think the Scottish child payment is an area where people who are receiving it's making an absolutely enormous difference. Yeah. I mean, this is really a tenant of Scotland's statutory child poverty targets. And this is one of the main policies the Scottish government are looking at to be able to try and do it. And from a... even thinking about a policy impact point of view, it's really easy to measure the impact that has on child poverty, because essentially you're just increasing the income of people in poverty with children. So it makes it, you know, it's quite a visible policy intervention for those people. Overall, though, public understanding of the devolution settlement and what it means in terms of tax and social security powers is very poor. And, you know, the knowledge about even that income tax is devolved, never mind that we have, you know, a social security system now in Scotland that is responsible for significant benefits, is likely only, you know, known to people if they're in receipt of those benefits and perhaps are transitioning from PIP to ADP and so on. So I think overall, the kind of understanding of this in public discourse is pretty poor.
And that will be the same. I mean, that's the same in Wales, certainly, in terms of that overarching thing around around devolution, and also about the powers that Wales has around income tax and other things. Can I just double check with you? The amount that you were saying in terms of Scottish child payment, is that £25 per child for under 16s or per household for under 16s?
Per child.
That's a significant amount of money then. That's huge.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
And on its own, you know, you can model quite, you know, this takes so many percentage points off our child poverty rate. You know, so absolutely, massive. Okay.
We're starting to get some comments in the chat, which is great. So do keep them coming. We'll come to Q&A in a little while. So you've also talked, Mari, about how, you know, in quantum, each of these changes means that Scotland's social security spending is going to be above that of the rest of the UK. How is the Scottish government funding it? You know, how is what choices are they making, and how are those choices going down?
Yeah, it's a brilliant question. The last thing that we can look at to really understand this in detail is the resource spending review that the Scottish Government produced in 2022. Now, this was the previous administration and finance secretary and so on, but basically it set out that the Scottish Government were going to prioritise health spending and spending on social security. You know, so because their priorities were about reducing basically reducing child poverty was their a number one mission and priority. So it meant that every other area of the budget, many of them had flat cash at best settlements. So this is about the enterprise budget, university funding, which will have other consequences, obviously, in the long run in terms of our so-called free tuition in Scotland. There's the police and fire budgets, justice system, you know, and then there's the local government budget as well, which has been quite constrained over the last 10 years. So they have quite openly made the choice that they are going to put any extra money that they have into these areas and deprioritise some of those other areas, although they don't like using the word deprioritise, of course. And I suppose the inflationary environment has allowed them to present it as flat cash settlements rather than cuts, mostly. But obviously in this inflation environment we're in, it essentially means like less quite significant cuts in some of these other services.
Well, that's the big topic, I think, in terms of Wales, and you know, the £900 million black hole at the heart of the Welsh Government and the work that's been done. So a short term prioritisation of health and rail transport is happening in Wales in relation to this budget. But what you're describing is a more strategic, tighter focus of the Scottish Government than that of the Welsh Government.
Yeah, I mean that's what they said in May of 2022, and then we had a number of issues within the 2022-23 financial year because of public sector pay disputes and the need to find more money for settlement of public sector pay disputes. It led to an emergency budget review in October of 2022, where not funding for social security, but funding for things that you could see would be related to lifting children out of poverty, such as employability services and you know, some of these other things were significantly cut. Funding for mental health services didn't get the uplift that was expected. You know, so there was some, you know, you could see that some of these cuts that were being made in order for basically for the government to fund these public sector pay deals, you know, would probably have an impact on the overarching goal of child poverty. But they chose to project these sort of, you know, direct transfers to households. Which makes a very visible difference to child poverty. I'm not trying to be cynical here, but you know, it's very easy to see. And I know we've come on to questions, but I can see from the chat, you know, how do we know what those households are spending that money on? We don't. But in terms of how poverty is measured, it's about your income compared to the median. So it has an impact on that, which is what the statutory child poverty targets are actually based on.
So it's another sort of interesting reminder of, you know, you're measuring the data that you have to fit the target that you're setting yourself. So those are all political choices as well in terms of that. But what sort of, I don't know if you know this, but what sort of evaluation is there in terms of the impact on people, who's doing that? Because, you know, there's one thing in relation, I mean, we're thinking about this in relation to Levelling Up, for instance, and how Levelling Up funds are being used in Wales and what sort of monitoring evaluation there is of the impact of them, as opposed to just the quantum going out of the door.
I mean, I would hope there is a significant process of evaluation going on with something like the Scottish Child Payment and understanding the impacts it's having, not just on, because we can actually observe the impact it has on income, obviously, but then what it has in terms of the outcomes for. But I mean, that's quite a long burn question, because, I mean, a lot of the focus, to be fair, of the Scottish Government in the last 10 years has been about early years and the impacts that investing in children has on the long run
So when was
you know,
the
of
first,
their outcomes in life.
when were people first transferred over? You're talking about it happening in phases. So the when was the first cohort transferred over?
So it's been very recently in the last 18 months or so, you know, so and then it was just sort of the payments were racked up until like this financial year. So in April it went up to £25. So I mean, it's all been very recent. And obviously we have been encouraging Social Security Scotland and the Scottish Government to ensure that they're collecting the data one would need to be able to understand the impact of this when we come into 3 years' time to actually evaluate it. This is always the problem though, isn't it, with government policy, including with levelling up. So little money is sort of dedicated to evaluation at the start, which means that when you're asked, as we often are as well as an institute, to evaluate policy interventions, you try and do it and then you're like, well, I can't because we don't have the data in
The
order
data
to be able
isn't
to
there.
do it. Yeah, the data isn't good enough. And we've done countless evaluations of different sorts of interventions where all we've been able to say after a lot of work is, well, we don't really know because the data isn't good
More
enough.
research needed.
Yeah, well, you know, if you don't collect suitable baselines and put in place suitable data collections, you just might never know if the policy is having the
No,
intended
and that's
effect.
an even greater challenge with the devolution of particular new powers as well, and the implementation of those new powers. There's quite a lot of prep that needs to be done up front. So just let's just unpick the kind of fiscal sustainability of this then. So, you know, it does it feel as though it's something that's only going to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and therefore there are going to be some very hard choices to be made further down the line, or even harder choices around what money is spent where, how, you know, how far ahead are things being projected and on what basis?
So, I mean, we're lucky in Scotland, and if you look at my bio, anybody, you'll see that I was a part of setting up the Scottish Fiscal Commission. So I would say it was a good thing. But anyway, just declaring an interest there, we do have the Scottish Fiscal Commission in Scotland. Now, this was set up kind of as a prerequisite for the whole fiscal framework being agreed. You know, lots of people, including the Parliament and the Treasury and at the UK level, were keen that there was an independent body who'd be responsible for the forecasts on which the budget would be underpinned. Because at the time when you're setting the budget, as we will do in December in Scotland, the income tax forecasts, which is the biggest chunk, are based on forecasts. So obviously you wouldn't want any bad incentives to get into who was doing this forecast. So we've got an independent body who does the forecasts for the economy, for the tax and social security powers that are now devolved to Scotland. So we have all of that independent analysis. They've also done their first fiscal sustainability report in January, which looked at the sort of overall sustainability of spending in Scotland. And that's on over a kind of 50-year horizon rather than just you know, the sort of 5-year horizon that they're doing when it comes to budgets. And there's both a short-term issue and a long-term issue in terms of sustainability in Scotland. It would appear for this current financial year that we're about to have the budget for that there might be as much as £1 billion gap between what the Scottish Government wants to do and what it has resources to do. So, you know, some of those tough choices are going to have to be made. And this is at the backdrop of the Scottish Government continuing to make announcements about things it's going to spend money on, such as a council tax freeze, as was recently done. So there's an actual like immediate issue about you know, funding priorities and how they're going to fill that gap, which could mean, I don't know, could mean more income tax rises. We just don't know. But there's definitely a longer term fiscal sustainability issue, which, to be fair, isn't just about Scotland. You know, it's the sorts of messages that come through the OBR's report for the UK as well, which is essentially given that health spending is going to, you know, swallow up a bigger and bigger part of the budget. How sustainable is it? You know, our current levels, particularly of taxation, for example, you know, to be able to sustain that, you know, over the next 50 years, and some difficult choices are likely going to have to be made in the future. Now, that's based on what we've seen in the past, which is as the population ages, healthcare becomes more complex. Healthcare actually advances, it doesn't become cheaper or more efficient, it becomes more expensive. You know, so that, I mean, that's based on that. And, you know, that's disputed. You know, some academics think that, you know, we will find ways to make public services more efficient, you know, as we use AI and other technologies to deliver it.
And there's also an issue about how you price in, you know, preventative healthcare and people living longer, but some of them living more healthy lives too. Is there a tipping point? I mean, I'm no health economist, but is there a tipping point?
Yeah, definitely. And to be honest, like the data on life expectancy, healthy life expectancy and all these things in Scotland in recent years has been pretty bad. I mean, you know, all of the progress that we've seen is sort of stalled. And you know, I'm sure many of you, the participants, know about lots of the specific Scottish issues we have in terms of health and living healthy lives. So those are the long-term fiscal challenges. I think the social security challenge is definitely presenting itself over the next 5 years, though, as you see it going from the devolved social security portion going from, you know, kind of around 10% of the budget by the end of the forecast horizon, it's up to 14% of the budget. And if you assume that the budget is more or less going to be quite fixed in, you know, in real terms over that period of time, what it means is that other services essentially have to eat that, and something has to give somewhere, because, you know, the Scottish government can't borrow for day-to-day spending.
So that's another thing, you know, the Fiscal Commission is kind of the equivalent of the OBR, isn't it?
Yeah.
To think of it like that. And there are other things that have been suggested similarly for Wales, but aren't yet in place, although we now have the Welsh Revenue Authority. I'm going to open up to questions in a tick, but there's one thing first around, you know, given where Scotland is now and how it's learnt over this process so far, what do you think are the kind of key lessons or learning that Wales can take from Scotland on these reforms? Key challenges, things to be thinking ahead, and how translatable is that learning for Wales?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing I'd say is the sort of wider infrastructure that's sort of required to devolve significant both tax and social security powers. And I know significant tax powers are devolved to Wales, but that wider infrastructure point is really important. And it's not just about being able to either collect taxes or to pay social security payments, you know, the kind of practical stuff. It's also the wider kind of policy making and analytical community, the wider capacity in think tanks and other supporting bodies to be able to hold the government to account and to scrutinise, the capacity of Parliament to be able to scrutinise the government and the decisions it makes, and the analytical capacity that it has and to be able to do that. And I think we have done a lot in that in Scotland. And I think the establishment of the Fiscal Commission, for example, has helped that. But also the Financial Scrutiny Unit in the Parliament has been significantly bolstered as well to be able to support committees, to be able to understand this new landscape really get it. So that is infrastructure, not just from you need to set up a body that gives out social security payments, but it's everything around that. And that really includes data. I mean, a lot of the challenges for the Fiscal Commission and Social Security Scotland have been about getting access to DWP data. So just to be able to understand, you know, what the base is for claiming, what take-up rates are, you know, to just be able to do decent forecasts and modelling and policy option modelling has been very challenging. And you know, that is a real issue. And it remains an issue for something like income tax as well, because HMRC are still administering the tax, even though the policies are being set, you know, in Wales and Scotland. You know, so these administrations don't have the same access to data as the UK government do to make policy decisions. I think it's a real issue. All of these infrastructure considerations need to be thought about. I guess the fact that it's taken twice as long and cost twice as much to devolve these, you know, broadly, to devolve these social security payments as was first thought, I guess, is a lesson in being realistic, particularly when you're talking about, I mean, it's one thing for somebody to have the wrong tax code and maybe be charged slightly the wrong tax, but it's a completely other thing if somebody who needs a payment and relies on it doesn't get it. You know, it's a whole other level issue that you cause a citizen if they don't get the payment that they deserve. And actually like rely on. So, you know, it's so important to get it right, and it's likely that transition should be, you know, long and well planned rather than, you know, to fit a particular timetable. So I mean, that's really important, I think, because it's like the stakes are just so much higher when you're talking about social security.
And we've seen that, haven't we, from the transition to universal credit in terms of that not being well
indeed, yes,
not being well handled. Okay, I'm going to go to questions now. Thank you very much indeed. There's a question from Diana Pye, who is a policy officer for Labour in Cunnan Valley and an interim policy officer for Merthyr and Aberdare, who's asking, what's the rate of means-tested payments for non-residential disabled people? Do you know that off the top of your head?
I do not know that, no, but okay. I can take that one away.
Okay, no, that's fine. Got a question from Kelly Huxley-Roberts, who's with the Lloyds Bank Foundation, just about where Scotland is on UBI, please, Mairi.
Oh, yeah, okay. So there's been lots of interesting research done on universal basic income or citizens' basic income or basic income, you know, people call them different things. We've done quite a lot of research on it over the last few years as well, and basically looking at the sorts of different models of basic income, because sometimes people talk about basic income, they mean different things from each other. So I would encourage you to have a look at our website, fraservallander.org, and look at our basic income research that we've done. We did some thought experiments about different levels of universal basic income, you know, whether it's at the floor of kind of the UC or, you know, getting up to what more people would consider actual income you could live on, you know, and so on. And how you, in theory, you could fund that through devolved tax powers. So essentially doing that thought experiment of how much would it cost to do that. So, you know, which showed that it's very difficult to think about doing it in a devolved setting because of the sorts of changes you would have to make to the tax system. It'd be very difficult to do it in that. And obviously, you know, you'd have to get the powers over all social security benefits to be able to do it in any case. So there's some practical discussions going on that were going on about that after we did that report. There was discussion about pilots happening in certain parts of Scotland. But I would say that the discussion around this in Scotland's very much moved on to minimum income guarantee rather than basic income. So we've done some other modelling and research across the UK about how much it would cost to introduce a sort of minimum income guarantee, which was more, you know, ensuring that anyone who falls below that is topped up to that level rather than a basic income. And the Scottish Government are keen to explore and continue to explore whether this is something that could be done in Scotland. So I'd say the debate has evolved more into that area because the practicalities and the cost of something like basic income just didn't seem feasible in general or in a devolved setting.
That's interesting when you look at, you know, the Wales pilot for care leavers that's underway at the moment. Oh. You know, will be evaluated, obviously. Great question. Thanks very much. There's a question here from Helen John about that £1 billion shortfall. Is that for between now and the end of March 2024 or for next financial year?
That's for the next financial year, thankfully, for the Scottish Government's point of view. So they still have the ability to make... Because it's been interesting because they announced that in May. And to a certain, and this was a part of their medium-term financial strategy. So this is sort of what the Scottish Government's equivalent of the autumn statement would be, I suppose. You know, the budget in December and then a mid-year kind of statement, which is supposed to kick off year-round budgetary discussion in the Parliament, you know, in May. It sets the scene and then the committees talk about their pre-budget reports over the summer and so on. And they said that then, which they had said £1 billion in 2024-25, perhaps going up as much as 1.7 billion in a few years' time. Now, it was a bit, this is my personal view, a bit of expectation management to the Chamber and the committees saying, look, if you're going to ask us for stuff for your pet area or your particular policy, it's pretty difficult. So you're going to have to help me figure out where on earth we're going to get the money from if you're going to ask me for anything. So a bit of expectation management. We've also had over the summer income tax receipts coming in a bit better than was thought through self-assessment receipts. So that took a chunk of that off. Maybe that knocked 400 million off their black hole, if you like. But then since the new administration's come in, we've had the Programme for Government, which announced a bunch of spending stuff. We've had the announcements at conference about council tax and extra money for the NHS. So it's probably back up to a billion again, given all those announcements. Everybody's waiting for the budget, which should set out because it has to add up to what they have.
Yeah.
So it's basically, well, where are the cuts going to come? And you can see already, you know, as always happens, of course, the interest groups are sort of marshalling to say, if you cut the fire service or the police service or justice system any more, then these are going to be the consequences, because people are sort of seeing that it's going to fall on one of these areas that they've not sort of proactively championed, you know, between September and now.
Which is always the challenge when it comes to budget setting, isn't it? And whose voices are heard loudly, and what political deals are in that mix. Thank you. There's a question from Meg Thomas, who's with Disability Wales. What should PIP also be devolved to Wales? What could be learned from adult disability payment and other aspects of social security that Scotland and or Wales should look to devolve?
I mean, it's a great question. I guess that's for the people of Wales to decide if they wish more responsibilities around social security payments. I guess I would caution that it's not without, you know, costs which might impact on other areas of your budget. And you know, if you say that the same deal was struck as was with Scotland in terms of fiscal framework and adjustments to your block grant. If you wanted to implement similarly more generous payments and a more generous system and a nicer system, barring any change at the UK level, of course, which there could be, I suppose, then that will then start to eat into other things that you want to spend money on. And that's the interesting thing about it being devolved to Scotland, is that obviously the UK government have an annual managed expenditure budget. You know, they don't know how much the whole of the social security budget is going to be, but if it's more than they think, then they can just borrow extra money.
Yeah.
And if it's less than they think, then they just have to borrow a bit less. Now, leaving aside, you know, UK fiscal sustainability and size of their debt and so on, you know, devolved administrations can't do that. So, I mean, there's a little bit of borrowing for forecast error and so on, but it's pretty limited. And they just don't have the same flexibility to be able to say, well, whatever happens, we'll make these payments. Whatever happens, they have to make those payments, but it means that money has to be found from elsewhere
Yeah.
in the budget to make those payments. So it's just some of these consequences that should need to be considered.
That leads us into a question, an anonymous question here, which is absolutely, do you think increased fiscal powers are necessary to take on more areas of responsibility? Because what you've essentially said is yes to that.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm sorry if I'm misunderstanding the question, but I mean, you would want at least to get the block grant adjustment from Westminster. You could, like Scotland have, if you had the power, introduce new benefits which didn't have any, you know, associated funding. But you know, it does mean you'd have to choose spending money on that rather than spending money on something else. You know, at least if it's devolved, there is that, you know. Well, here's the money that we would have spent on Wales if it wasn't devolved. You can have that, which comes to fund it. So yeah, you know, I think, you know, there's people here who are much more au fait with the Welsh Act of 2017 than I am, but there isn't the same powers, I don't think, in there as there is in the Scottish Act to create new benefits and administer them.
No, I don't think there is. And if anybody knows differently in the chat, do put it in the chat. There's a really good question here from Rhysap Gwilym, who's an economist at Bangor University. Nearly half of all UK DWP benefit spending is on people of pension age. If Scottish government are prioritising alleviating child poverty, to what extent does the current settlement allow that balance to be shifted in Scotland? Or does increasing child payments necessarily mean taking money from elsewhere to increase the overall size of the benefit system?
It's a really great question. I mean, I suppose if you look at the beneficiaries of social security, it's an interesting way to look at it, isn't it? In terms of demographics, you know, the people either in terms of income deprivation or households with children or households with pensioners and so on. I mean, we all know, of course, when you look at the poverty statistics, that the pensioner poverty has come down significantly over the last 20 years, whilst child poverty has come down, but then has sort of crept up again as people in work have had their benefits significantly cut since 2010. So, you know, it's definitely the case that it's the in work working age people who have had their benefits significantly reduced in real terms, while pensioners have been much more protected. So I suppose if you look at the quantum of social security payments in Scotland, given there's additional child payment, and then more relatively speaking, more money given to people with disabilities who might be of working age, you could see that balance would be slightly shifted, just because the Scottish Government are choosing to fund extra payments from it within their budget. Of course, the state pension remains reserved, but if you look at the quantum of social security spending in Scotland, still the biggest single item by far is the state pension. And, it absolutely dwarfs everything else. It's just so much bigger than anything else. But, I mean, the state pension, the triple lock, all of these things in terms of the sustainability of them should be live policy discussions, I think, for all of us, because as how we fund social care.
Could Scotland choose to break the triple lock then for Scottish pensioners?
No.
What would
it's
need to
deserved.
Okay.
We need to be devolved.
Yeah. And there's a question here from Peter Hugh Jenkins, who works for Ruth Jones MP. Not requiring continual reassessment for long-standing concerns clearly reduces a level of cost of and bureaucracy. Is there any added complexity on an admin side with the Scottish system versus the England and Wales system?
It's a great question. I mean, I certainly think that looking at Audit Scotland reports anyway, and I mean, I'm no expert on work capability assessments, so there'll be other people more able to talk about it than me. I certainly think that it's been more complex than was expected by the Scottish system, because it's taken much longer to set up and much longer to transition than was hoped at the beginning. But I think these are the sorts of questions for wider evaluation, I think, in terms of the outcomes that a different approach to citizens generates overall, both in terms of the efficiency of the service, but also, I guess, more importantly, the outcomes for the citizen involved.
And knowing what you know now from the experience in Scotland, what's your opinion in terms of where Wales could go next on constitutional reform around this package of issues, welfare and social security?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I know there's a lot of work to look at the sort of package of power, well, the sorts of social security support and infrastructure that there is in Wales, and to make it more coherent, I suppose, or more, and I think that's an excellent sort of way to look at it in terms of the way that Wales supports its citizens. I mean, I think I would think carefully about the sorts of powers you want and why, and what you want to do with them, and to what extent the Scottish Government would, in terms of its current makeup and previous makeup, it sort of we find it very difficult to say no to any power. But for kind of obvious reasons, in terms of their long term view of what they want for Scotland, but I think it's always important to ask, what would we do with this power, and would we have the associated resources to be able to do what we want to do with this power without having adverse or unintended consequences elsewhere? As I say, the package of powers that's been devolved to Scotland, given that Scotland tends to be older and sicker and more generally has higher rates of things like disabilities and so on, it does make it quite a challenging fiscal position, because it's likely to eat up more and more of our budget
as we go along. So that's in relation to the UK average. I don't know how Wales and Scotland compare on those rates, because that's also something that we talk about in Wales in terms of our population being older, poorer, or sicker. And I think some of these issues, we need to sort of step away from Welsh exceptionalism on this.
Yep.
There are other parts of the UK that have similar issues. The question is, what are the powers that other parts of the UK have to address these issues?
But just before anyone on the call who has a fiscal background screams at me, I realise completely that that Scotland has benefited hugely from the level of funding that we've got through Barnet over the years, and if we really looked at a needs-based approach to funding, Scotland would be likely to do as well as it does, as it has done through Barnet. So I totally recognise that. In terms of spending, the per head on the same service, and I think, we do a lot of work at the Institute to kind of explain that to citizens in Scotland.
But people don't, and with very good reason, people don't necessarily want to know where the money comes from. What matters is that the money is there and that they can live their lives as they want to live them. Fantastic. I don't think we've got any other questions from the audience, but do please keep posing them if you want to. I've got another it's a question here from Joe in terms of, the challenge of communicating that complexity. It's obviously not straightforward because it's about the plumbing and the infrastructure behind things too.
It's hugely challenging, and I'm an advisor to the Finance Committee at Scottish Parliament. Help advise them on the budget process and so on, and they do a lot of work trying to public outreach and to talk to citizens about things that are the decisions that are being made in the budget process, and it's massively challenging. And people's eyes glaze over when you mention the words block grant adjustment and fiscal framework, and I totally understand that. Trying to explain why an income tax cut in England could be beneficial for the Scottish budget because it will reduce the size of the deduction from the block grant, and all these sorts of things, but then it increases the differential in income. It's so complicated. And then you talk about all the social security payments, and then the fact is based on forecasts, and then you have reconciliations when the forecasts turn into outturn, and it's so complicated. And to a certain extent, that's the legacy of under the sort of Smith Commission principles and everything else that happened. Barnet was to be retained, and everything that we have done since the significant devolution of tax and social security powers has been. So we have to just burn it. And some of that in Scotland, to be blunt, is because it's beneficial for Scottish funding. So people don't want to reopen that can of worms. But it just makes it so complicated. The UK tax and social security system is already horrifically complicated. And then on top of that, in Scotland, we've Christmas treed on all these other things that make it even more complex. And we've ended up with some weird interactions between devolved and reserved taxes, like income tax and NICs, and all of these strange things have happened to the income tax schedule. Yeah, so it's really complicated, and it's hard to explain it to interested government officials, never mind the citizens. So it's a huge challenge,
I think
and I'm
that's
not sure how to kind of to surmount it, except to try and keep doing the things, sort of things we do, which is to try and explain it in an accessible way as much as we can through the media or through our blogs or through our guides and so on.
It feels like it's right for it's a bit like a whack-a-mole kind of, something goes down here, but it pops up somewhere else. Those unintended consequences, but also right for a sort of visual explainer in some way in terms of what comes in.
And just to say that, people like Audit Scotland and SPICE, the Parliamentary Information Centre at the Scottish Parliament, do a great job on these sorts of things to try and explain it as best they can.
And there are, I think your comment around what else is needed around the infrastructure to enable this to work is one that's very well made, and there are some suggestions currently being made on that score. But also, we've got a whole range of change coming up in Wales in relation to potential expansion of the Senedd, potential greater scrutiny. What do you do with that potential expansion, and how do you use that for improved scrutiny as well as some of the what would an equivalent of the Fiscal Commission look like to be able to provide budgetary and financial backup of modelling and research to current Senedd members as well as for what that expanded Senedd might look like. We've got time for one more question, I think, and I'm going to take the one from Rhys ap Gwilym, which is: one might hope that the devolution of benefits would change the incentives of the Scottish Government in addressing the underlying causes of the demographic and sickness issues that drive benefits costs. And is there any sign of this occurring yet?
It's a great question, and certainly the priorities around. So we take the inactive population in Scotland, for example, who are inactive due to ill health and disability, which is much higher than the UK rate, and particularly high in particular parts of Scotland. And you know, through the wholesale devolution and responsibility for employability programmes, there has been a big focus on focusing on those people who are very far from the labour market, and sort of, you know, trying to get them into work. Unfortunately, as I said earlier, quite often that seems to be the area where the axe falls when there's pressure. And that not only means that obviously you don't get the longer term benefits of those, you know, sorry, yeah, the benefits in the other sense of people being in work rather than claiming benefits, or being in work in addition to their benefits. You know, so that's definitely a bit of an issue where, you know, I guess some of short-term decisions are made which are not going to deal with the sort of long-term problem. But the Scottish Government do see that a lot of these issues are have poverty at their heart, and that's really the issue that they need to tackle, which they haven't been, you know, to be fair, shy about talking about. But, you know, I am concerned a little bit, you know, of course it's important that we tackle child poverty, but what about single people with disabilities who are in poverty, for example, and they can feel quite forgotten in this discussion, I think.
And I think there was another point that was raised by the IPPR in relation to what happens in terms of devolution of benefits to potential impact on economic growth and inequalities across the UK, and push and pull factors on that front. Mari, thank you very much. I think your last question has also addressed some of the points of Lydia's question in the chat. So I just want to say a huge thank you, Jochen Varian, to you for joining us today, and to everybody else in the room for joining and contributing to the discussion. These events are possible thanks to the support of the Legal Education Foundation. So I'd like to thank them too for their support to our work on Wales's constitutional futures. Our aim in these open and free events is always to identify issues that need further thought and articulate clearly what those issues are, get people thinking about what needs to change, why, and crucially, how, so that we can all play our part in making Wales better, which is the IWA's mission. If you want to share your feedback on how today's session today, please do so via the link in the chat. And if you want to receive early notifications of future IWA events and recordings of all our sessions direct to your inbox, without even having to go and look for them, please do join us as a member on the supporters page of our website at iwa.wales. Thank you very much indeed, everybody. Jochen Varian, bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Mari.